Meeting of Parliament, Thursday, 29th of July, 2021. Suspension of standing orders. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with the laying of documents on the table.
Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Papers to be laid. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the annual report of the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2013. The annual report for the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2014. The annual report of the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2015. The annual report of the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2016. The annual report of the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2017. The annual report of the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2018. The annual report of the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2019. And the annual report of the Board of Charity Commissioners for the year ended 2020.
Ordered to lie. We now continue with answers to oral questions. We commence with question number 186, and the questioner is the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Speaker, can government say how many parking spaces were recently sold to lessees of Harbour Views and how many parking spaces still remain to be sold, giving the reasons why this is so?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, there were 316 parking spaces available for sale at Harbour Views. Completions are pending in respect of 11 parking spaces due to extensions of time requested by the lessee's lawyers due to current workloads.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can the Chief Minister please confirm that there are none pending to be sold, because 316 were sold, 11 have to be completed. Do any parking spaces remain unsold as such?
The information that I have, Mr. Speaker, suggests in the way that I have expressed it that there were 316 available for sale, of which only 11 remain as yet unsold, in the sense that the completion has not occurred, but the sale has been agreed.
Next question. Question number 187, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government now state the number of people within the civil service public sector who have taken sick leave on the grounds of mental health issues, particularly depression and or anxiety, for every month since January 2021?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer with question 188.
Question number 188, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state the sick rate for the civil service over the last 12 months?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, trying to make sure that I've got the right thing for him. The information requested in relation to the number of officers is not available in the form requested, as the data currently collected relates to the number of sick days only. This has now been uploaded onto the government website. As the statistics were not published online at the time that the questions were submitted, I now hand over a copy of the information available to the Honourable Gentleman. Mr. Speaker, the sick leave rate for the civil service over the last 12 months from July 2020 to July 2021 is 2.1%. Mr. Speaker, I'm also happy to ask that the statistics should be compiled on the basis of number of officers, which is not what we had agreed last time, but if the Honourable Gentleman thinks that that is useful, I'm quite happy going forward to also have it compiled in that way, so it's uploaded to the website in that way.
Speaker, I'm very grateful. What I'll do is I'll digest these figures, and if I can come back on a supplementary afterwards. But it's very helpful because we've had this discussion with the Chief Minister, and the Chief Minister actually stated that this data is very, very very useful information for the government as well as the opposition. So I'll come back with a further question if necessary. Thank you.
Question number 189, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm that the Board of Charity Commissioners have been submitting annual reports on operations as required under Section 4.5 of the Charities Act? And if so, why have no reports been tabled in Parliament in recent years?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Board of Charity Commissioners have recently provided their annual reports for the years 2013 to 2020. I've had the pleasure to lay them on the table today. No annual reports can be found for the period 2003 to 2011 when the Honourable Member's Party was in office. And no records exist for 2012 either.
Next question.
Question number 190, the Honourable K.S. O'Parody.
Mr. Speaker, have government changed the departmental procurement procedures for supplies, materials or equipment in the education or other departments, and if so, how and why?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as I've already stated in answer to question 212 of 2020, in March 2019, the government introduced a purchasing and procurement policy, which lays out the government's policy and procedures for government departments when sourcing goods, services, and or works. As part of the government's digital transformation initiative, government is currently overhauling its manual processes, including introduction of e-sourcing, e-ordering, and payment digital platforms. These platforms, together with robust reporting tools and audit trails, simplify and provide a greater level of supervision and monitoring of government spend. The Department of Education is one of the latest departments to adopt all of the aforementioned platforms. Procurement via the e-sourcing platform, as opposed to the former three-quote system, is increasing competition and transparency of government spend and allowing the market to price itself. Departments now have a tool that lets them explore suppliers via what they sell, allowing startups an equal opportunity to bid for government work. Departments not using the e-sourcing platform continue to use the former three-quote system. The policy also prohibits departments from using market-limiting specifications and includes an ethical code of conduct for dealing with suppliers.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure, is this a sort of a written policy that was put in place, or is it guidance, just internal guidance to departments?
Mr. Speaker, I think that, as I stated in answer 212 of 2020, it's a written policy, and it's a new system that is being implemented, and people are trained on the system, etc., etc.
Mr. Speaker, some of the feedback that I'm getting from especially in the education department, that the former process used to be that when you got to the end of the, towards the academic end of the year, subject leaders would basically need to source certain things for their particular courses, and what they would do is they would go online and obtain a sort of best price quote for a particular good, but that they are being told now that they need to go through these new processes that I imagine is partly what the Honourable Member's talking about, and that is, in some cases, making the purchase of the particular article or good more expensive. Is the Chief Minister aware of that, and if not, will the government look into those matters? Because I assume that the purpose of the changes would be, as he said, to create better value for money. So if it is that there are people in particular departments that could previously feel that they could source goods at a better price, perhaps there should be an engagement with the government on that, and perhaps he'd look into it.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Department of Education is one of the few departments that, for exactly that reason, is able to contract outside of the e-procurement platform where better value for money opportunities are able to be obtained. So I'm very surprised that the Honourable Gentleman is being told that, because in fact the opposite happens to be the case. And indeed the whole raison d'etre for this new electronic digital purchasing and procurement policies to prevent waste, abuse, corruption and mismanagement.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that, and I'll certainly go back to the people who gave me information, and with the assurance that the Honourable Member had just given, that in fact, depending on the department, but certainly in education, it happens to be one of the few departments that can do that and can still proceed as it used to. Are there other departments that can also do that? I'm not sure if the Honourable Member heard my question. Yes?
Mr. Speaker, the procurement department itself suggested that in the Department of Education it was necessary to continue to operate on the basis of teachers being able to source materials outside of what may be available locally because the UK's system of education, which is the one that we marry entirely, sometimes provides for there to be greater opportunities for procurement of things at even lower prices than may be available locally. So my understanding is that this happens in education. I don't have a note of it being available in respect of any other department. And I'm being told by the minister who rolled out the policy that, in fact, there is a carve-out for the Department of Education in particular because of the nuances that I've just referred to.
Next question.
Question number 191, the Honourable K.S. Oparavi.
Mr. Speaker, how many Gibraltar banknotes were issued during each of the last three calendar years, namely 2018, 2019 and 2020, and how many have been issued in the 6 months to 30th of June 2021?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the following were the banknotes issued by Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar during the last three calendar years and the 6 months up to the 30th of June 2021. In 2018, 1,153,700 banknotes were issued with a value of £20,485,500. In 2019, 1,442,000 banknotes were issued with a value of £24,376,500. In 2020, 699,500 banknotes were issued with a value of £12,714,000. And as at the 30th of June 2021, 386,800 banknotes have been issued with a value of £6,225.
Sorry, I asked that without pressing my microphone, so maybe I should ask that again. In respect of 2018, 19, 20, and indeed, so in the last three calendar years, given the numbers he's spoken about, what is the process? Is it that these notes are new and then replace ones in current circulation?
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's not a direct calculation, but as banknotes come in, if they are no longer in a decent state, they are retained and retired from circulation and replaced by new notes. But it's not a direct relation. In other words, you don't put out only one new £20 note because you've collected one that is not in a fit state of circulation. You sometimes add more, you may add less than you have collected.
Mr. Speaker, just to understand the process a bit, I guess the banknotes are issued on the instruction of Her Majesty's government, then presumably arrive, and they are they're kept in treasury, I guess, and is it a sort of treasury decision to sort of issue them into the economy? How does it work?
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that this is a demand-led service. In other words, as the banks ask for more currency, we provide the currency that they seek. We tend to have sufficient in reserve to be able to issue more, but we also have to be careful not to have too much in reserve, because obviously the security costs of keeping large amounts of cash can outweigh the value of keeping large amounts of cash available in the government's own custody.
So, Mr. Speaker, then, is it fair to say that while the Chief Minister has given me a statistic on banknotes issued, there would then be other information if I were to ask the question of banknotes released into the economy by Treasury? Is that right?
So, Mr. Speaker, no. The answer to that is no. This is the amount of currency released into the economy. It may be, I hesitate to invite a question which we may not be able to answer, but just following through the discussion that we're having, it may be that we may be able to tell him how many we have dematerialized, in other words, how many we have cancelled as they've come in, to know how much has been worn as it's come in. But the honourable gentleman should know that it is likely that we will never be able to match up the calculations, because some people may simply retain currency. Some currency may have flown in the sense that it may have left Gibraltar and collectors may have taken it, or tourists may inadvertently have taken it, expecting to be able to exchange it wherever they may be or use it wherever they may be. So those issues mean that the calculations will never reconcile exactly.
Next question.
Question number 192, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, will government remove the 10% import duty on personal inputs on goods that can be used for remote education and work?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as I have already made public in my recent budget address, there will be no significant changes to import duty tariffs at this point.
I understand that, Mr. Speaker. The information, the motivation for the question is we're getting feedback from people. I mean, there's been a culture change in the last 18 months. People are working from home and so on. And perhaps it would be good in the future for the government to reflect on what it can do to facilitate that climate for working from home, and perhaps this is one of the measures that the government would look at when it does so.
Well, Mr. Speaker, my retort in that respect would be that he's asked about two key areas of economic activity, education and work. Anything which is for use in education already attracts no import duty. And the Honourable Gentleman said things which are going to be used remotely in education. Well, if they are for education, they are already at zero. And if something is going to be used for the purposes of remote working, one of the parts of my budget address which set out how we are supporting that was in the allowance which we are providing for equipment for businesses, so that any equipment purchased, in particular, as I said during my budget address, for remote working, is now attracting a very, very generous allowance at a tax level. So he asked about education and he asked about the workplace. In education, already items which are for education are not charged duty, import duty, and in the workplace we've given the benefit in the context of the allowance.
I mean, I think that's right, and I accept that. Of course, the allowances you talk about, the Chief Minister talks about, are in relation to business, and the question is more directed on personal inputs. So someone who wants to work from home as a sort of self-employed, I'm not sure they would have the benefit of those allowances, but perhaps if they do, then the Chief Minister will clarify that.
Mr. Speaker, the allowances that I'm referring to As he, I think, will recall in the context of my speech, corporate allowances and deductions which are permitted. In the context of the self-employed, the sort of instrument that I imagine he is referring to is a laptop, for example, that might be purchased for the purpose of working from home. Now, in that context, Mr. Speaker, a laptop would be seen as a multi-use piece of equipment, which would be used both for work and for entertainment, as well as for the purposes of booking personal excursions into the hinterland, for example. And so, therefore, is not be considered something which is entirely for work purposes, for issues related to duty. If it were in the context of a corporate that is purchasing a computer for an office, then the attitude is different. Indeed, if an office is purchasing a computer for an individual to work from home for the office, the attitude is different because the business has made the decision to purchase the instrument for work. This is the treatment that is given both at income tax and corporate tax level and on import duties.
Next question.
Question number 193, the Honourable K.S. Opana.
Mr. Speaker, can government provide a schedule of the property sales crediting government-owned property companies for the calendar years 2018, 2019, 2020 and 2021, the latter up to 30th of June 2021, broken down by cost of the sale and identifying the purchaser and vendor and the price of each sale?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question with 194.
Question number 194, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, can government provide a schedule of the land and property sales crediting the Improvement and Development Fund for the calendar years 2018, 2019, 2020 and 2021, the latter up to 30th of June 2021, broken down by cost of the sale and identifying the purchaser and vendor and the price of each sale?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman a schedule with the information requested. As the Honourable Gentleman knows, some of the statistical information requested is already published on the government website in a generalised format. It is not possible to accurately provide the Honourable Gentleman with a breakdown of costs for each of these sales. Additionally, as the Honourable Gentleman should be aware, we're not able to provide information detailing the purchasers and vendors of each sale, as this would be in breach of the Data Protection Act. Mr. Speaker, I can also confirm that there are no sales between the INDF and the companies.
Mr. Speaker, I was staring at the schedule when the Honourable Member was talking, so I'm going to ask the question, and if he said it, then he will forgive me and maybe he can repeat the answer. I accept, I understand what he says about the, perhaps, you know, the identification of particular purchasers and vendors. I understand that to some extent, although I will need to reflect on it further and see. But in terms of individual sales, why is it that that we could not be provided the information in respect of individual plots, you know, particular properties, even on an anonymized basis and with particular prices? I don't understand that.
Mr. Speaker, can I just say, I think that we could provide him vendors. I didn't want him to misinterpret what I said. When I said that it would that we could not provide information detailing the purchases and vendors of each sale, we're talking about each transaction. But of course, the vendors could be disclosed because the vendors are the government in its various incarnations, right? Whether it's a GRP or whether it's the government itself. Of course, we could disclose vendors, but the reference there is to the relationship between the vendor and the purchaser, who are the people whose information we hold as data controller, and I am advised we cannot disclose. Mr. Speaker, as for the breakdown of the cost of each property, which is what he asked us for, it's very difficult to be able to understand what the Honourable Gentleman is saying. So, for example, what is the cost of sale of a property at the Walks? Is it zero because we received that property from the MOD under the lands deal? Or is it the $60 million that it's cost us to relocate the MOD under the lands deal divided by the number of properties that we took from the MOD, plus all of the legal fees associated with all of the transactions involved in ensuring that we have title in an entity that is able to sell and then able to give a head lease. So we really would find it very difficult to do that calculation on a property-by-property basis. Mr. Speaker, also in relation to the properties in question in particular, I think it would be very difficult to now recreate a schedule in the time available which sets out every plot number and name against an amount. The government does not account in that way, Mr. Speaker. And therefore, going back to recreate that now would be extraordinarily complex. But of course, this information is, if I may say so, of course, publicly available in the context of all of this being registered land and all of the sales having to be registered. Remarkably, though, the information being publicly available, we are not able to provide it. That is to say, if the government, through GRP, sells a property to K.A. Azopardi, then the government and K.A. Azopardi go and register that sale, probably twice. We probably register the sale of the property, which is the conveyance, and probably, well, depending on his salary, we might also register a mortgage in respect of that property. So there's a double registration in respect of that. Yet we are not able, as data controllers, to give his name across the floor of the house. And that doesn't mean that the information is not public. It's just that it can be made public by the government as data controller in that way across the floor of the house. I hope that's helpful to him.
It's helpful to a certain extent, but it doesn't provide us with much more, although I understand what the Honourable Member is explaining. But can I just go to his table, if I may, and just ask a couple of questions? And as I say, we will reflect further on the process that he has described in accordance with what is available publicly, and then perhaps we can ask more refined questions if necessary. So, GRP investments, the property sales crediting government-owned companies, I can see a number of figures, but the one that really stands out there in 2019 is this 88.4 million property sales crediting GRP Investments Company Limited. Can the Chief Minister clarify what that's about?
Mr. Speaker, it's what we invited them to my office to explain. That's the Aruka transaction.
And then equally, in relation to property sales crediting the INDF, the 59.67, is that also part of the Aruka Hassan Centenary kind of transaction?
Mr. Speaker, I think that is different. I think that is at the end of the MOD process, there had been an expectation to put $60 million into the INDF, and that, I think, is the payment of all of the land MOD land sales which were available at that time, principally. Now, it's not the whole $59 million. I've said $60 million because that is the amount of the book transaction, if I can call it that loosely, of the sale of land, which the government of Gibraltar would do with the properties we received from the MOD under the lands deal that they did, 59 million will be sales of land generally into the INDF that year, and a large portion of the amounts of sales of those MOD property transactions into the INDF at that time. I think that's exactly how it was made up, but I would have to look in detail to the breakdown of it in order to be able to satisfy the Honourable Chairman.
And if the Chief Minister could also then clarify the other sums in the INDF in respect of 2018, 2020 and 2021, the nature of those particular transactions. So the same question that I've asked in relation to the 2019 figure, can he clarify, has he got information in respect of those figures for 18, 20 and 21? So what's the 16.83 million in the INDF about, and so on?
So, Mr. Speaker, those are the general property sales, and there will be different elements. So there will be 10 million in there, which will be the sale of the Victoria Stadium to the GFA, and 6 million in there will be the sale of the Victoria Stadium to the GFA. You'll recall it was 16 million. 10 was paid in 1 year, the balance was paid in another year when certain conditions precedent had been complied with. I forget we've shared that in the House, or we were monitoring it in the House. So that is the other large transaction that I can recall would have been included in there. And otherwise, there'll be, you know, other sales of land which mount up and go into the INDF.
And then finally, Mr. Speaker, can I ask about the GAR Limited, not a company that I'm familiar with, but my learned friend, my honourable colleague, Mr. Clinton, yes, elevated, my honourable colleague, Mr. Clinton, has given me some information, but can he perhaps clarify what the 3.4 million in respect of GAR Limited is?
Not at this stage, Mr. Speaker, because I don't want to say something which might inadvertently be incorrect. And I don't think I've got the information here with me. And given the number of questions the Honourable Gentleman has asked, I don't want to say something which might lead to the House being misled. I'm very happy if he wants a fuller breakdown of that and he writes to me. I'm quite happy to provide it. But from what I can see here, and sometimes things are provided in a type that it is no longer possible to read, age 49, unless he holds it for me whilst I read it to him at a distance. I'm afraid I can't assist further.
Next question.
Question number 195, the Honourable K.S. O'Parady.
I think part of this has been
answered. Does government have information as to when it is expected that the EU's negotiating mandate for purposes of talks on a future relationship treaty with Gibraltar will be published, and when the talks themselves will start?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman is aware, and as most of Gibraltar now knows, the draft EU negotiating mandate was published in quite unfortunate terms, if I may say so, going beyond the realms of my script for the first answer, on Tuesday, the 20th of July, 2021.
Yes, and I think there is common ground that that the contents of the mandate is unfortunate, to say the least. As I think we have both said, it does not provide a basis for a way forward, and we certainly on this side of the House wish the government luck in the negotiations to obtain a, what I have always called a safe and beneficial agreement for Gibraltar. So, Godspeed on that. The second part of the question was when the talks themselves will start. I don't know if the Honourable Member has something that he can update people listening who will be interested to know.
Because there has been a technical fault, we're going to have a rerun of that last question.
Well, let's just go through the whole question. Question 195, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, I'm reminded, thankfully it's only one question, by the way, I'm reminded of the Father of the House may remember that many years ago when I was in government, he and I debated some EU treaty, I forget to say what, to remember what it was exactly. We went for an hour and a half on a recorded debate on GBC. I went back to my office only to be rung by GBC to say that the recording hadn't worked. Could we come back and do it again? And obviously, we all decided not to. But on this occasion, Mr. Speaker, it's only one question, so I think we can manage it. We have a script in front of us. Does government have information as to when it is expected that the EU's negotiating mandate for the purposes of talks on a future relationship treaty with Gibraltar will be published, and when the talks themselves will start?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, take two. As the Honourable Gentleman is aware, the draft EU negotiating mandate was published on Tuesday, the 20th of July, 2021.
Mr. Speaker, grateful for that, and I think I already said that we wish the government well in trying to secure a safe and beneficial agreement for Gibraltar. In follow-up, I also asked when the talks themselves will start, and perhaps the Honourable Member can comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As I indicated a moment ago, the Government of Gibraltar and the Deputy Chief Minister and the negotiating team, and indeed all my Cabinet colleagues and I, do not consider that this mandate can form the basis of a treaty that we would be prepared to sign up to. But having said that, Mr. Speaker, in terms of the answer to his question as to when the negotiations would commence, the government of the United Kingdom has also set out that it does not believe that this negotiating mandate can lead to a successful treaty. And together, the government of Gibraltar and the government of the United Kingdom have set out our own mandate, which is faithful to the New Year's Eve agreement. And we have been ready to start the negotiations for a treaty which were faithful to the New Year's Eve agreement. Since March, when the Foreign Secretary came to Gibraltar, and we issued that mandate here on the Rock, and we remain ready to do so, and the fact that that it will be August next week would not prevent us, Mr. Speaker, from being ready to start those negotiations next week, as we would have been ready to do so in March or April earlier this year, Mr. Speaker. So, and we do hope that the Council of the European Union, when looking at the draft mandate, will consider the issues that we have already said publicly about the concerns that the Government of Gibraltar and the Government of the United Kingdom jointly have about the mandate and why we don't think it can lead to a successful negotiation. And I do hope, Mr. Speaker, that the final conclusion of this chapter in the history of Spain, the European Union, the United Kingdom and Gibraltar will be that we are able to see a successful conclusion of what the Honourable Gentleman refers to as a safe and beneficial treaty by the time that we are saying that we are closing our books on this and not closing our books in the absence of a treaty.
The Honourable Elliot Phillips had a number of supplementary questions he wished to put in relation to questions 187 and 188.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful. First of all, I'm grateful for the Chief Minister for providing this this data. And when you drill down on some of the detail and get out Mr. Clinton's abacus in order to analyze some of these figures. Does the Chief Minister agree that this is a worrying statistic generally in relation to those sick days that are taken for mental health conditions? On our analysis, they amount to, in particularly this year, to 25% of all sick leave days taken in respect of the civil service, and in respect of last year, a full year of 2020, amounts to 21%. Now, in the United Kingdom, according to the rather limited research I had to do on this particular question, it amounted to 11%, Mr. Speaker. So, in essence, what I'm asking the Chief Minister is whether this does concern the government, that this rate appears to be quite close to double than that of the United Kingdom for mental health in particular. That's the first supplementary. I do have another one, if the Chief Minister...
Mr. Speaker, absenteeism due to sickness must always concern us as an employer. We need to know that we are ensuring that our employees are being looked after in an appropriate way and that we're discharging our duty of care to them. And, of course, the government, therefore, took steps some time ago in order to have occupational advice available, and we have added that expertise in our human resources department in order to try and address some of the problems that some officers may be having. I would say, of course, Mr. Speaker, that 2020 and 2021 are probably the worst possible years in order to assess the prevalence of the instance that the Honourable Gentleman refers to. And unfortunately, as I indicated to him when we first had his question, we did not have this statistic, and we are going to now start seeing the statistic compiled and maintained, and we'll be able to compare like with like and decide whether the trend tells us anything. In particular, 2020 has been probably the most stressful year, something I have lived through, and I know that many public officers have felt the same thing, and many people in the private sector have felt the same thing. So this may be, conversely, the best year in which to make the assessment as to the difficulties that we are experiencing for that reason. So we'll have to see that in the run of play. Of course, Mr. Speaker, I would say that in the context of that 25% and that 21%, you would be classifying what I might call the classic Gibraltar certificate of unfitness, which is anxiety and depression. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I think that we need to carefully consider whether we should be as concerned as the figures at first blush suggest from a mental health point of view, or whether from an employment and productivity point of view we might have different concerns that we might also as a community need to address in a different way. So I think that the Honourable Gentleman's question has helped us to identify numerically the issue that we may be dealing with, but not necessarily enable us to identify genuinely what sort of level of mental health issue we may be dealing with in the public sector. Although in 2020 and 2021, the rules are different, I think, given the stresses and strains that the pandemic has put on all of us, where there is probably much more genuine anxiety and depression than there has been in the past, when there might have been an equal number of certificates granted in that respect.
Speaker, I agree with much of what the Chief Minister has said, save that insofar as the point that he makes for 2021, and although it's been a special year, if you look at a comparison between the United Kingdom from 1995 right down to 2021, the trajectory for sick leave and absenteeism has gone straight down. So UK this year had the lowest 1.8, even in the context of COVID, because they found that furlough, social distancing, home working actually drove down absenteeism. So
which sort of runs contrary to the suggestion, if I can put it at that at its highest, that the Chief Minister is making, that it's been a particularly stressful year. I think it has been, of course. But whether that then relates into the data, I get from his question that the jury's really out, because we still need to crunch the numbers a bit more to really understand what the true level of sickness is and whether it's in acceptable limits, because clearly sickness and absenteeism creates a very huge burden on countries' economies. So, you know, for the United Kingdom, I think it's £350 million the public versus affected by absenteeism as a result of sickness. And globally, the economy of the United Kingdom is £77.5 billion. So what I'm suggesting to the Chief Minister is that if we can potentially get data back beyond that period of time so that we can start drawing a chart that allows us to have more of assessment. Is that within the government's sort of data range? Or I'm trying to be helpful, because whilst I agree with most of what he said, I think it's probably too soon to tell. And in fact, the trend actually in the United Kingdom is very, very different.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman will forgive me for saying that I'm getting anxious and depressed just at the thought of having to reconstitute the statistics for years gone by, not least because we were told when he last asked the question, he'll recall, that statistic had not been maintained and that it would be very difficult to reconstruct it. That's why I said to him when he asked, well, look, we agree with you that this is an important statistic to maintain. Let's maintain it from here on in, and then let's have the trend. Of course, Mr. Speaker, it means that the trend will start in a pandemic period, which is not necessarily going to be what you might call ground zero for the purposes of calculation, not necessarily an average year. And I do hear what the Honourable Gentleman says about the United Kingdom. Of course, the circumstances of the United Kingdom are very different to the circumstances of Gibraltar in the context of the world of work, not least because of the distances involved in going to work. And an individual staying at home to work from home is something that is more likely to be necessary in the public sector in the United Kingdom, where people might have to commute to work, rather than in Gibraltar, where people were asked to stay at home, not because of the distances to commute to work, but because we were operating teams A and B in the public sector, and people were working but working from home, and others were working but working from the office and then swapping so that we could ensure that we could continue to provide public services. So I don't think that the Honourable Gentleman can take a direct extrapolation of what we see in the United Kingdom. I believe, like him, that if we went back and were able to reconstruct the data, we might realize that we're starting from different bases to the United Kingdom. And on my feet, I have the idea that although it may be very difficult for the government to recreate the information from the point of view of the government as an employer, it may be possible, and I really don't know whether this information is maintained already electronically. The Honourable Lady is here and she may be able to assist us and find out. It may be possible that as the provider of public health services in Gibraltar, we might be able to say, without looking at whether it's private sector or public sector, how many certificates of fitness or non-fitness for work on the grounds of mental health issues, the principle of which will be anxiety and depression, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, have been granted in years before 2020. Now, that will not match up, Mr. Speaker, with the data set that we are now providing, which will be very precise and very particular, and will be for the public sector, because in the health services, those certificates will be polluted with information from those who might be working in the private sector, although the incidence of sick leave in the private sector is, my gut tells me, lower. But my gut is not a statistician, as he knows. So, Mr. Speaker, I'll see through the good offices of the Honourable Lady whether at least we have that information, and we might at least be able to see when digitisation arrived in the GHA whether those things which are written on fitness for work certificates are maintained in electronic form, or whether we would still have to go back to the actual certificate, which might make it just impossible to do in the time available. Not in the time available, because we're not now 5 days from a question, but whether it would be a particularly laborious exercise to do.
We now proceed to answers to written questions. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to table the answers to written questions W8 of 2021 through to W22 of 2021.
Suspension of standing orders. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with government bills.
Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Bills, first and second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Imports and Exports Act 1986 and the Integrated Tariff Regulations 2017. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, can I ask that the House proceed with the other bills before I do that, because I think I have to identify the letter I've sent you on abridgment, etc. So if we could proceed with the other bills, I will then be able to proceed with the constitutional abridgment also.
We then proceed with the second reading of a bill for an act to amend the Public Health Act to control the emission of smoke by vessels and for connected purposes. The Honourable Minister for the Environment, Sustainability, Climate Change and Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, I will refer the House, as I will later in committee stage, to two letters that I addressed to you, one dated the 29th of June 2020 with an amendment, and the other one dated the 3rd of June 2021 with a further amendment. And clearly we will need to change the date to 2021 as is normal. Mr. Speaker, in recent years, public concerns regarding the environmental and health impact of maritime pollution have increased. This is because maritime transport is a considerable contributor to air pollution and carbon emissions. However, significant environmental improvements are obtainable by changing shipping practices. Of particular concern has been the practices of vessels whilst in ports or in close proximity to inhabited coastal areas. In Gibraltar, concerns have been expressed about the impact that the emission of smoke from vessels may have on air quality and respiratory health. The 2019 GSLP Liberal Manifesto committed to introducing legislation to control emissions from ships, especially black smoke. In developing the bill, consideration was given to the position adopted by a number of other jurisdictions, including the United Kingdom, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malta, Spain, and Dubai. The legislation present in Hong Kong, Malta, and the United Kingdom were considered most appropriate, given that A, they specify a fixed period of time beyond which emissions of smoke is prohibited, and B, they do not provide any person with the discretion to consider whether the smoke is a nuisance or dangerous, thus providing more certainty to the public as well as to ship owners and masters. Ultimately, the bill most closely resembles the Maltese legislation, which is more stringent in its application of defences for the prohibition than the legislation currently enforced in the United Kingdom. In summary, Mr. Speaker, the bill introduces a new Section 92A to the Public Health Act. In the part of that Act which addresses nuisances and offensive trades, and in particular under the subpart dealing with smoke nuisances. The bill creates a prohibition not just in the port, but within the entirety of British Gibraltar territorial waters on the emission of dark and black smoke for prescribed periods of time. The term smoke has been defined widely to include soot, ash, grit and gritty particles emitted in smoke or steam. It will therefore not be possible to avoid sanction under the bill by claiming that the emission was steam and not smoke. Identification of dark and black smoke will be by reference to shade 2 and 4 respectively on the Ringelmann chart, which is a scientific scale for measuring the apparent density or opacity of smoke. It's used in Hong Kong, Malta and in the United Kingdom to identify smoke emissions from vessels. In relation to dark smoke, being less opaque and therefore likely containing fewer polluting particulates than dark smoke, the relevant time limits for emissions are contained in a table introduced into Schedule 22. The table describes certain events which are likely to inevitably result in emissions of some smoke, such as a breakdown in combustion equipment or when a vessel must force its combustion equipment due to navigational difficulties. In these cases, the vessel is prohibited from emitting dark smoke for between 5 and 10 minutes or more within an aggregate of 1 hour. This is subject to the additional restriction that it must not emit dark smoke continuously for over 3 minutes. In relation to black smoke, vessels are prohibited from emissions which exceed 2 minutes within a period of 30 minutes. By way of illustration, Mr. Speaker, if a vessel emits black smoke for 90 seconds and 20 minutes later does so again, it will be in breach of the prohibition. The intention of the bill is to deter reckless or inconsiderate emissions which can be avoided by cleaner and more responsible shipping practices. It therefore includes two defences for vessels which emit smoke in circumstances where the incident cannot be avoided. The first relates to emissions taking place in circumstances where there is a risk to life or to the safety of the vessel. The second defence relates to circumstances where smoke is emitted as a result of a failure in the vessel's furnace. However, this defence is limited to cases where such failure cannot reasonably be foreseen or provided against, and that after the failure of the furnace occurs, the emission of smoke cannot reasonably be prevented or minimised. There is an exemption, Mr. Speaker, which applies only to Her Majesty's Navy or ships belonging to the Government of Gibraltar whilst employed for the purposes of Her Majesty's Navy. This exemption is necessary to comply with certain constitutional arrangements, in particular that matters of defence in Gibraltar are the remit of the United Kingdom. The consequence of breaching the prohibition is that the ship owner and master will each be guilty of a criminal offence and liable to a fine of up to £5,000. This is a higher penalty than is currently present in other port jurisdictions such as Malta, Singapore or Hong Kong. It's considered that the level of the sanction will not deter operators of vessels with environmentally conscious shipping practices from stopping at Gibraltar. However, it will encourage those who may be reckless as to when and how they emit smoke to take more care when in Gibraltar waters. The Royal Gibraltar Police, the Department of the Environment, the Gibraltar Port Authorities and Maritime Surveyors all frequently patrol or overlook Gibraltar waters and will play an important role in witnessing and recording any emissions which may be suspected to be in breach of the prohibition in order to ensure enforcement is carried out effectively. And I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable Elliot Phillips.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, just very briefly, of course, this side of the House will fully support and endorse what the Honourable Minister for the Environment has said. Of course, this legislation is a long time coming, and have there been a number of incidences that have been widely reported by our journalists within the community and have been, to be fair, responded to by the government in quick order, Mr. Speaker. I take the point that this legislation has been moulded around the regime that exists in Malta, and we have learnt experiences from those in other territories such as Hong Kong. And when I did look at this bill way back when it was first published, of course, the particular permitted periods that are contained in the schedule to the bill reflect those, I think, of those that were contained, well published in Hong Kong. So, of course, we will support this, Mr. Speaker, and any measure that the government will introduce to improve the quality of the air, particularly as it relates to the shipping industry. Mr. Speaker, I would ask one question for clarification, if the Minister is able to do so. And this is a concern that's been raised to me by activists in this particular area in terms of air quality, who have said to me in a quite forthright way that there is other forms of pollution emanating from vessels that might also contribute to air pollution that might not be described, as the government is describing it, as dark smoke or black smoke, Mr. Speaker. And therefore, if the government could give an indication as to what it will be intending to do insofar as those emissions that affect the quality of the air that we breathe, Mr. Speaker. But we on this side of the House will certainly support the legislation as proposed.
Does any other honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable Marlene Hassan on.
Mr. Speaker, I associate myself with the comments by my honourable friend and approve of this bill, as I will always approve of any measure aimed at tackling and mitigating pollution and improving, of course, the quality of our air. Mr. Speaker, however, I hope we can continue to reduce our exposure to these kinds of harmful pollutants, and that we can look towards a horizon in which black smoke is not only reduced but actually disappears completely from our skies. So needless to say, of course, I shall be voting in favour of this bill.
The Honourable Gilbert Likudi.
Mr. Speaker, this is a bill which I worked on with the Honourable Member, the Minister for the Environment, when I was Minister with responsibility for the port. And it is, of course, an important bill. But it is also important to look at the context and the effect of the bill. As the Honourable Member, the Minister for the Environment, has rightly said, the main purpose of this bill is to provide a deterrence. So the people that come to Gibraltar, so the people that bring ships to Gibraltar, know that we have this piece of legislation and that it would be an offence to act in breach of this legislation. Now, I do note, and of course it will be for the Honourable Minister to reply to Honourable Members opposite, but I note the Honourable Mr. Phillips says this is a long time coming, and there have been several incidents which have been shown on social media. Certainly, it is good that we have legislation in place. So to the extent that this could have been done before, yes, it could have been welcomed. The issue is, what practical effect would it have had? And is it correct that there have been several incidents which may not have happened if this legislation had been in place? Bearing in mind, in particular, that the purpose of the legislation primarily is deterrence, rather than to see ships spurting dark or black smoke, wait the appropriate number of hours or minutes, and then go and say, right, you've committed an offence, we're prosecuting you, and we're fining the owner and the master. That is certainly not the purpose of this bill. Certainly during my time as Minister with responsibility for the port, I cannot think of one single incident of the various that we have seen, photographs or some videos. I cannot think of one single incident which would have fallen foul of this particular bill, because this talks about particular periods of time or an aggregate over a particular period of time of dark or of black smoke. And the reason for that is, and the Honourable Member opposite has recognised the efforts that the government has made in dealing with this matter. And one of the issues that I wanted to highlight is the proactive efforts that are made in Gibraltar, in particular by the Port Authority, and something that I was obviously made aware of when I had that responsibility. And I wanted to comment on one or two incidents which were brought to my attention where there was some dark or black smoke, and it is not unusual for ships to issue a little bit of black smoke when the engine is turned on. That is quite normal. What is not normal is for a ship to have dark or black smoke over an extended period, which is what this is intended to stop. But there have been one or two occasions where the Port Authority has seen an emission of dark smoke and has acted very, very promptly indeed. As honourable members will know, the Port Authority previously was at the North Mole. Now it is at a very privileged position in a very good vantage point at near Lathbury Barracks, where there are views of the bay, there are views of the whole of the Straits, there is a view of the east side. And whenever there has been an occasion when there has been an unusual amount of dark or black smoke for a short period of time, those on duty have acted proactively by calling up the captain immediately and asking them immediately to stop that, if necessary, by switching off the engines. And that has happened on a number of occasions. So what I want to do is to commend the proactive nature of the approach that has been taken throughout the various years, certainly since we've been in government, by the Port Authority, commend the efforts of the captain of the port and the diligence of the captain of the port, the deputy captain of the port, and all the staff that do look after this, despite the fact that we didn't have the bill in place. So it is not that this is necessary to stop that happening, because that has been stopped and nipped at its bud every time there has been any sort of indication, even though there wasn't a legislative backup to send over a police officer to arrest somebody or to prosecute somebody. This gives that cover whenever that that happens, but importantly, it provides that deterrence. But I do want to make clear that the government, the Port Authority in particular, has always acted swiftly and thoroughly to stop these occurrences happening, and this will be a mark that Gibraltar will not tolerate this sort of behaviour, and that ships that want to flout environmental protection laws are not welcome in Gibraltar.
The Honourable Professor John Cortes.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. First of all, I would like to thank the Honourable Gilbert Ligouthi, not only for his contribution now, and we have been in touch about this bill for quite a while, but also for his own personal help and that of his team in the discussions and the research that went into drafting this bill. And I absolutely confirm how proactive the Port Authority is and how close it works with the Department of the Environment in dealing with these and other issues out in our waters. So I want to thank the Honourable Mr. Ligouthi for that. Also, obviously, to thank both the Honourable Lady and the Honourable Mr. Phillips for their support. There have been a number of delays, as we know, due to the House not meeting perhaps as frequently because of COVID, but nevertheless, we are where we are now. Obviously, I would like to just add, I was going to say that earlier, that clearly this has also been discussed with the current Minister for the Port, the Honourable Vijay Darinani, who totally supports it, as does the rest of the government. On other measures for other contributions to negative air quality by shipping, there are some that are being considered, including, and this has been mentioned before, I think possibly in this House, the question of onshore power, which I know is being considered in certain cases, and it's something that we clearly have to keep under review. So I thank honourable members across the House for their support, and once again commend the bill.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Public Health Act to control the emission of smoke by vessels and for connected purposes be read a second time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Public Health Amendment Act 2020.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee state and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee state and third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to amend the Inputs and Exports Act 1986 and the Integrated Tariff Regulations 2017. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move for an act to that a bill for an act to amend the Imports and Exports Act 1986 and the Integrated Tariff Regulations 2017 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Imports and Exports Act 1986 and the Integrated Tariff Regulations 2017 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against, carried.
The Inputs and Exports Miscellaneous Amendments Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, this bill was published on... this bill was published on Tuesday, Mr. Speaker, and I certified this bill as urgent under Section 35(3) of the Constitution, as I indicated I would do during the course of my reply on Monday to honourable members' budget addresses. I have a copy of the letter that I provided to you, Mr. Speaker, in case any member has not had sight of it. Mr. Speaker, this year... we have made very limited changes to the duty tariffs, and despite it being over 2 years since we last effected significant changes. We said, I said during the course of the budget debate, and I confirmed today to the Honourable Member in answer to one of his questions, I didn't think it was prudent to do so, given the discussions that are still to be held in respect of the potential treaty between the United Kingdom and the European Union on the basis of the New Year's Eve agreement framework, and the possible changes that that could bring to our import duty regime in the near future, so long as those changes are changes which are acceptable to the government of Gibraltar and which we consider would be in the trading interests of Gibraltar and the Gibraltar businesses that we all represent in this House. So, Mr. Speaker, the amendments that I made were the ones only that I referred to in the context of that reply and in the measures that I set out in my original speech on the general principles and merits of the appropriation bill for this year. Mr. Speaker, the amendments therefore provide as follows. With respect to fuel import duty, and to give a wider interpretation than is presently the case of the term ship, Section 2, interpretation, of the Imports and Exports Act will be amended to include a reference to vessel, which will include any ship, tug, lighter and boat of any kind whatsoever, including a jet ski, whether the same is propelled by steam or otherwise, or is towed, which I am advised, Mr. Speaker, are terms which are still terms of art and relevant in the context of the movement of vessels. I haven't seen a steamship in Gibraltar waters for many years, Mr. Speaker, but I'm told that this could still be an attraction that might feature one day in our territorial sea. Sections 64 and 70 of the Act are amended to include the words, save in such cases as are prescribed by regulations, to allow the government on a case-by-case basis to make changes by regulation to the provisions of these sections, which refer to exemption from duty of aircraft and their parts and certain fuel oil, and also the refund of duty on motor spirit re-exported, respectively. And that's a term of art from the legislation. In order to continue to raise revenues from the consumption of polluting fuels, the import duty rebate on motor spirits supplied from land and otherwise to vessels less than 18 meters in length and used for non-commercial purposes, that is to say, those who are fueling a hobby or a pleasure and not those
who require fuel for professional purpose is reduced by one-third, and the supply of these fuels will therefore attract one-third of the relevant fuel duties. And any diesel fuel supplied from land or otherwise to vessels less than 18 meters in length, used for non-commercial purposes, will now attract 12 pence of duty per litre, roughly the same amount as will be due by the reduction of the rebate by one-third in respect of other fuels. Non-commercial purposes, Mr. Speaker, however, will not include vessels used by the government departments and authorities, agencies, law enforcement agencies, or such other persons as the government of Gibraltar may designate from time to time. These increases, Mr. Speaker, will retain Gibraltar's attraction as a port for visiting vessels, but will also provide much-needed revenue for the public coffers at this time. As part of the government's continued efforts to curb the health problems arising from smoking, as well as our commitment to tackle all illicit tobacco smuggling and in line with the provisions of the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the import duty per carton of 200 cigarettes will be increased also by 50p to £15.50 per carton from the date that I announced last week during my budget address. That is reflected, Mr. Speaker, as an amendment to the Integrated Tariff Regulations for 2017 by substituting a duty rate of £75 per 1,000 cigarettes with the rate of £77.50 per 1,000 cigarettes. Mr. Speaker, I therefore commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, in respect of this bill and indeed another bill that is on the agenda, which I'll repeat the point, we will support this bill. It doesn't engage on the issues of principle that we were talking about at budget time. I say nothing. I just rise really to say that the Chief Minister prefaced his sort of incursion into this bill by making some remarks about the possible impact of the EU treaty into our imports and exports sort of framework. I say nothing about that. I'm sure in due course, should something be on the table, there'll be plenty of debate on that issue. I don't know if my honourable colleague, Mr. Clinton, will have something to add on this bill, but we will support it.
The Honourable Roy Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My only point is to echo what the Leader of the Opposition has just said, and also, in fact, to say I, in fact, welcome the prompt bringing of the bill to the House, as indeed the other amending bill to the Income Tax Act to bring into effect the budget measures, as this will indeed make life easier for the Income Tax Office and practitioners alike, and of course the general public. I will, Mr. Speaker, make some fuller comments when we come to look at the Income Tax Act. Thank you.
The Honourable Marlene Hassan on.
Mr. Speaker, thanks. Just to say very briefly that I will be supporting the bill because increasing import duties on petrol is a clean and green way to generate revenue. So I will be supporting the bill. Thank you.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful for those indications of support in respect of the revenue-raising aspects of the appropriation. These are absolutely the right measures for Gibraltar now in the context of the administration of our import duties and the raising of revenues from importations to Gibraltar for all the reasons that I set out, Mr. Speaker, in my wider address on the appropriation last week. And I will simply, of course, point out to honourable members that I do have great difficulty in understanding their political logic, but it is a matter entirely for them. They haven't voted that we should be able to spend the money that we receive to pay the civil servants and public servants of Gibraltar and provide the public services that we provide. But they are voting, Mr. Speaker, to raise the money that we will spend on that basis. And that, of course, is a matter entirely for them, which we've ventilated already. But, Mr. Speaker, I very much welcome their support in respect of this bill.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Imports and Exports Act 1986 and the Integrated Traffic Regulations 2017 be read a second time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Imports and Exports Miscellaneous Amendment Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that... I beg to move to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today, if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
Aye.
A bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010 be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Income Tax Amendment No. 3 Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, for the same reasons that I indicated a moment ago, I have given notice that although this bill was published on Tuesday, it should be dealt with under the provisions of Section 33(3) of the Gibraltar Constitution as being too urgent to permit the expiry of 6 weeks. Mr. Speaker, I understand all honourable members have had notice of that, and the Leader of the Opposition has indicated his acceptance of the reason for that. And I should say a little more about that, given what he has said a moment ago, just to reflect on the record, Mr. Speaker, that what we jointly consider to be the urgency in the context of these bills is to ensure that our statute book, our corpus iuris, is provided with all of the provisions which we have announced already bite, as from midnight on the night that I delivered my first budget address on Tuesday, the 20th of this month, and that should now be provided for as soon as possible in our laws. And so the urgency, Mr. Speaker, that I think we are agreeing is the relevant urgency, is that our laws should be up to date as soon as possible with the charging of duties and in this case, relief from taxation, which the House has by the majority vote of the government side, provided for, because the only reason that the House has passed the appropriation bill, as honourable members of course know, is because of our vote, but to ensure, therefore, that the budget provisions are in our law as soon as possible. So this isn't an urgency of something external that is happening and we have to provide for. This is an urgency of our own agreed motion to ensure that our laws are up to date as soon as possible. So, Mr. Speaker, this part of what we're doing, the Income Tax Amendment No. 3 Act 2021, gives effect to the measures announced which are designed to encourage investment and growth in our economy and which are designed to provide incentives for business as we transition into an environment after the impact of both our exit from the EU and the aftermath of the COVID pandemic. Mr. Speaker, as I mentioned previously, the other income tax measures announced in my budget address, such as the increase in the rate of corporate tax from 10 to 12.5%, and the increase in various allowances and the changes to the taxation of higher executives possessing special skills and Category 2 individuals, and the changes to the environmental measures have already been dealt with because those measures are measures that are amended by way of regulation. And the regulations that provided for those changes were published as legal notices 330 to 345 inclusive. Turning now to this bill, Mr. Speaker, what this bill does in clauses 1 and 2, which provide the usual introductory provisions, is to deal with the remaining aspects of what I announced. And clause 3 in particular provides for the amendment of Schedule 3 of the Income Tax Act in the following terms. By subclause 2, it provides for a new deduction to be available to any person carrying out or exercising a trade in or from real property situated in Gibraltar,
and those persons will be able to claim a deduction of up to 1% of the acquisition cost of eligible properties against the assessable income for defined accounting periods or years of assessment, subject to anti-avoidance provisions designed to prevent the abuse of such an incentive. No deduction can be claimed by persons already claiming the deduction commonly referred to as the industrial buildings allowance. So this is a different allowance, but it will not be one that you can add to the industrial business allowance. It's either one or the other. Subclause 3, Mr. Speaker, increases the first year allowance for both plant and machinery and computer equipment for defined accounting periods or years of assessment, allowing for greater investment and upgrade of infrastructure and equipment. The amount allowed as first year allowances had remained unchanged since these were first introduced, and it is now, and now is, we believe, the right time to increase these allowances in order to assist in jump-starting our economy. Subclause 4, Mr. Speaker, accelerates capital allowances of the pool of qualifying expenditure for defined accounting periods or years of assessment, enabling businesses to get these benefits as soon as possible in order to assist them during these difficult and uncertain times. Subclause 5 amends the definition of plant and machinery for the purposes of the pool of qualifying expenditure by extending this to include full electric vehicles for defined accounting periods or years of assessment. Previously, the definition excluded private motor vehicles or those not used in the ordinary course of the trade or business. In line with my government's green agenda, Mr. Speaker, and as I more particularly set out in my initial budget address, we will now allow capital allowances on all full electric vehicles, including up to a maximum of 50% of the eligible sum, where the full electric motor vehicle is used partly in the ordinary course of the trade or business. It no longer has to be wholly for the trade or business. The existence of this anti-avoidance measure ensures that no one is able to abuse this measure and benefit in a way that was not intended. Subclause 6 extends the existing deduction for training costs by an additional 10%, taking this up from 50% to 60% for defined accounting periods and years of assessment. This increase is designed to incentivize businesses to continue to invest in training in the workplace. And subsection 7 introduces a number of new deductions similarly designed to promote growth and expansion whilst preserving the existing labour market and seeking to attract foreign direct investment. Paragraph 18, which is to be added to Schedule 3 of the Income Tax Act, provides for a deduction for defined accounting periods or years of assessment in relation to marketing and promotion. Under this measure, persons will be able to claim a further 50% of eligible marketing and promotion costs, reducing their tax burden proportionally whilst investing in promoting in the jurisdiction and putting Gibraltar on the map, or on the Google map, Mr. Speaker, as we might say these days. The costs within scope include those incurred in promoting products or services to consumers in relation to the production of the assessable income of the trade or business in or from Gibraltar. Paragraph 19, which is added to Schedule 3 also of the Income Tax Act, provides for a deduction for defined accounting periods or years of assessment in relation to fixed payroll costs. Those persons eligible for this measure will be able to claim a further 50% of eligible fixed payroll costs, ensuring that there is an incentive to both retain and expand the workforce in tandem with a reduction in tax costs at these difficult times. These measures ensure that we assist businesses where it is needed at this crucial time. Fixed costs exclude variable payments such as bonuses, incentive or compensation payments, overtime and allowances, and those employees registered in employment as at the 1st of July 2021, which are within scope. Presently, these amendments to Schedule 3 of the Income Tax Act apply to accounting periods or years of assessment ending in the period extending from the 1st of July 2021 up to and including the 30th of June 2021. Paragraph 20 allows the Minister to amend the amount of any expenditure, allowances or deductions, or extend any time period in relation to these measures by way of regulations, negating the need for an amendment to primary legislation allowing necessary modifications to be expedited. Mr. Speaker, I should have said from the 1st of July 2021 up to and including the 30th of June 2023, which is the way that I announced it during the course of my budget address. So, Mr. Speaker, for all those reasons, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. Equally, as is the case in respect of the Imports and Exports Act, which we took just before this one, obviously we welcomed the measures that will give relief to business during the budget session that we had last week, and so we will vote in favour and support this legislation. We also welcome the principle that legislation should be brought to the House quickly and simultaneously with the budget session so that there is clarity in the legislation, and that's good for industry. So we certainly also support that aspect. It's something that my honourable colleague, Mr. Clayton, has been talking about for some time. Mr. Speaker, on the detail itself of the bill, there is one section, though, that perhaps the Chief Minister will comment in his reply, and it is something that was, of course, not mentioned in the budget measures themselves, which is a sort of general power section, clause 20, which is an insertion of a power in the Income Tax Act, where the minister will, by regulation, have an ability to amend schedules, etc., which may then mean that the government doesn't come to the House when in future budgets and does it by regulation. And I wonder whether that is something that should happen, and perhaps doing it this style, this innovative now style of presenting this bill might not be a better way forward rather than doing it by regulation. And then generally, Mr. Speaker, as I said before in respect of the Imports and Exports Bill, and just to place it on the record, we're going to support this because we welcomed these aspects in the budget measures. So the Chief Minister, in his comments on the reply on the Imports and Exports Bill, said he struggled with the logic. With all due respect to him, and I'm not going to rerun the budget debate, which was lengthy, but it would have been obvious to anyone listening to our speeches why we voted on the principles that we did. I think he is clever enough to understand that, and it's rather disingenuous to say otherwise. I think it's perfectly obvious from the face of the contributions made on this side of the House why we did so. This bill does not engage that, and we're quite happy to support it.
The Honourable Marlene Hassan on.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, this bill aims to create fiscal incentives for businesses to invest in things that I think are necessary for our economy, and it might provide some relief from the significant increase in costs with the huge hikes in social insurance and what they represent for businesses in Gibraltar. The question, Mr. Speaker, is whether this bill will be sufficient and whether the deductions it includes will be of use for some of our smaller businesses. We will have to see the impact of these measures in practice, but many in our business community are extremely worried about the impact that an increase in their costs coupled with a downturn in business will have on our small business ecosystem. But I do support the merits and the principle of this bill, and I will be voting in favour, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
The Honourable Roy Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, first of all, I think I need to disabuse the notion that the government actually voted on anything other than the appropriation earlier this week, because when we talk about the measures and the appropriation, they are two different things. And, of course, the appropriation bill that they voted on was only about expenditure. We are now discussing items which I have pointed out before should properly come in within a finance bill. And the father of the House will, I'm sure, be able to confirm that in the past, when he debated a finance bill, he would perhaps vote in favour of a particular clause or against another one. But there would be a discussion about the particular measures, whether to increase the tax or give an allowance, or perhaps the allowance should be higher or lower. So, Mr. Speaker, this sort of process Although we have brought it in today, as the leader of the opposition has said, in a rather innovative way, obviously my preference would be for a finance bill which would wrap everything up. But we are deprived, perhaps, over the years, of the ability to debate particular measures in depth. And so, well, actually, perhaps we should go a little bit further or a little bit less. And this is, and of course, you can't have that kind of discussion in the appropriation bill because that's not what it's about. The appropriation is about the appropriation. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, for whatever reason, the budget measures have been announced during the appropriation debate, and we have in our minds taken it that they are one and the same, but in fact they are not. Which means, Mr. Speaker, that when the Chief Minister sits down at the end of his contribution on the appropriation bill, in fact, none of what he says has any legal effect because, Mr. Speaker, quite simply, it doesn't figure in the appropriation bill, which is eventually voted on. In order to bring it into effect, Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister has to, by regulation, publish the amendments, and today we're seeing another amendment to primary legislation, which at least we are now having the opportunity to talk about in, as it were, real time and not perhaps a year or two later, which is a bad habit that the House has fallen into. So, as I said before, I welcome that this is now brought together as promptly as possible, and I agree that it should be done as quickly as possible after the debate. But let us not conflate a finance bill measures with the appropriation bill debate. They are completely different things, Mr. Speaker. Of course, you know, if you are having healthy revenues, you may not choose to raise tax or change anything to do with tax. But the actual legal mechanism is separate, Mr. Speaker. And so, of course, it is entirely plausible that you may disagree with one thing on the appropriation bill and agree with something else on the budget measures in the finance bill, which this is effectively what we're doing today, a pseudo-finance bill in an innovative way. Mr. Speaker, in terms of the Income Tax Act, as the Chief Minister has pointed out, there are six amendments which have gone through by way of regulation, and we have this amendment today on the allowances that will come in, which, of course, we can only welcome in that they stimulate the economy and help businesses to recover. So in that respect, obviously, that is welcome. But I am slightly concerned, as the Leader of the Opposition has pointed out, Mr. Speaker, that there is also a power in here to allow the Minister to amend things by regulation, in which case, Mr. Speaker, in future we would be deprived of the opportunity to debate any changes in respect of these sorts of allowances or deductions. But other than that, Mr. Speaker, you know, in terms of what we need for the economy, you know, we have no problem supporting the bill, other than with that reservation about the clause at the end giving the Minister the power to amend by regulation. But again, as I say, Mr. Speaker, there's a huge amount of difference between a finance bill and the appropriation bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I thank honourable members for their contributions. Mr. Speaker, the contributions that we have heard, I will seek to generously deal with, trying to put aside the controversy that we always find in the context of the debate of the Appropriation Act, because the Appropriation Act has grown into a sort of state of the nation debate. And many nations, I was watching today, in Spain, for example, have at this time of year a sort of state of the nation exchange. In Spain, party leaders sort of value the political year at this time. In the United States, it's done at the beginning of the calendar year. And our tradition comes from the Westminster tradition, where at budget time, there is a general debate about the state of the nation's finances, and the state of the nation's finances sort of reflect the state of the nation. So, Mr. Speaker, trying to leave that aside, I will try and deal with the contributions that we have heard by seeking to very generously describe them as absolute nonsense. The reason that they are absolute nonsense, Mr. Speaker, is that honourable members will have noted
that the measures that we are dealing with under the Income Tax Act, which they've indicated they will be supporting, are deduction measures. They are allowances. All of the measures, which one would have considered to be the controversial measures, the increase of corporate taxation by a quarter, right? 2.5%, 25%. The increases in taxation to high executives possessing special skills and the increases in taxations to category two individuals, all of those, Mr. Speaker, have been dealt with by way of regulation. In other words, the increases, Mr. Speaker, are dealt with by way of regulation. Mr. Clinton says from a sedentary position, as a friend of mine used to say, a sedentary position, that we should have had a finance bill. Well, Mr. Speaker, I say to him with the very greatest of respect that he has to understand that the legislation that we have is the legislation that his party put on the statute book. And the legislation that his party put on the statute book provides for all of those things to be amended by regulation, right, Mr. Speaker? And the Honourable Gentleman cannot say from a sedentary position, by Joe, because on the face of the document, he has his answer. This is the Income Tax Act 2010. And however much I tried in 2007 that Sir Joe should have been Chief Minister, by 2010, we didn't achieve it. And this act was brought to the House, Mr. Speaker, by the GSD government. And it provided that the increases of taxation that should usually give rise to a debate, the Honourable Gentleman said, whether we think things should go up more or less, would not come to the House for a debate, that there would be a mechanism for those things to be amended by way of regulation. Let me just conject an argument for that, Mr. Speaker. Let me just conject an argument for that. The leader of the father of the House was reminding me that in the 49 years that he has been here, when there were finance bills, the finance bills were never successfully amended by the opposition. Their party, Mr. Speaker, when it was in government, brought in a tradition, and this is why I have started by reflecting the relatively international tradition in different parliaments of having a State of the Nation moment, either in a parliament or outside it. Their party brought in a practice which was to have an appropriation debate where the leader of the House, the one that they sought to keep in power in 2011, Mr. Speaker, well, did I say they? Some of them, Mr. Speaker. The smile on Mr. Phillips' dulcet face reminded me that he wasn't quite trying to keep Sir Peter in power in 2011, and neither was the current leader of the GSD trying to keep the GSD in power in 2011. He was saying, I suppose, in shorthand, a pox on both the houses of the GSLP and the GSD. But the practice that had been brought about by the GSD, which we have simply continued, is to bring an appropriation act, Mr. Speaker, during the debate of which, apart from debating the state of the nation, announcements are made as to the increases of certain dues, duties, taxes, etc. Mr. Speaker, we were very concerned about that for reasons not dissimilar to the ones Mr. Clinton has set out about provisions raising dues from individuals in any way, shape, or form, which were not followed up by pieces of legislation. And we've tried to be very careful when there are increases which are not provided for by way of regulation to do them as soon as possible, except, of course, the last few years have been a disaster, as I've admitted on a number of occasions. In particular, Mr. Speaker, in the context of social insurance contributions, the father of the House and I had a blazing row, I believe, Mr. Speaker, you might even have been here in a different guise at the time, with the then Chief Minister about the fact that he was raising social insurance and not having legal cover to do so, for a reason, Mr. Speaker. The things that we're dealing with now, tobacco duty, et cetera, do not amount to deductions from a wage packet. The social insurance contribution, in some instances, is a deduction from a wage packet. So, not only have you got an instance where you are raising the dues of an individual without legal cover, simply because you announce it from here, you are, to boot,
going against the provision of something which honourable members might recognise when I refer to it, called the Track Act. The Track Act is an old Victorian provision that says a man's pay packet is sacrosanct, and you can only deduct from it the amounts which are agreed with him or which the state provides, which he is deemed to have accepted. And there would be, in the time when they were in government, deductions from pay packets done before laws provided for it or individuals agreed to it. Now, we were very concerned about that, and we raised that at a number of debates, and the Honourable, the former Chief Minister, then Peter Caruana, insisted that it could be done, and insisted that it would be done. Not least because the government was the largest employer and would be making the deductions. Many in the private sector would be paying the social insurance contributions on a quarterly basis in their reconciliations, and so therefore it was done in that way. Well, Mr. Speaker, we thought it was entirely wrong, and we were very concerned about it. And that's why, Mr. Speaker, in particular this year, we have wanted to make the announcement in relation to social insurance contributions before the budget. And the Honourable Gentleman, in one of his public statements in relation to this, raised why this was being done before the budget. The reason for that, Mr. Speaker, is that the date on which social insurance goes up for the purposes of the accounting period is the 1st of July. And the Father of the House, who'd taken over, was very concerned that it would create an accounting issue for people. And I don't know whether it's an accounting standards issue or an accounting issue for people, if you put something up, but you do so retrospectively, because we will be having a budget debate on the 20th of July, but in respect of the position for social insurance contributions as from the 1st of July, when some people who are weekly paid might already have had their pay packets. So that's the reasoning, Mr. Speaker. But this bill is to provide allowances. In other words, it's the opposite. Right? In the Imports and Exports Act that we've dealt with, we were raising the duties in respect of particular things. But there, of course, Mr. Speaker, you're dealing with a relationship between the collector and those who import tobacco, who import it into bond, where the collector can impose conditions, and the announcements having been made, it is the accepted practice that those who import into bond are not charged until the legislation is changed, and therefore they know, because there has been an announcement, what the government's intention is from a particular period in time, etc. And in relation to fuels, there is also that arrangement, because we're talking about a small number of importers. There's 12 tobacco wholesalers and I think two or maybe three wholesalers of fuels. But here, Mr. Speaker, what we're doing with this bill is bringing charges down or giving allowances. The Honourable Gentleman's address in relation to the debate that we would have in this House would make sense in the context of the raising of taxation. But his party has provided a mechanism for itself and future governments in order to be able to deal with those things by way of regulation, in the context that we've demonstrated, because we have raised corporate taxation by signing a regulation. And so, Mr. Speaker, in addressing the concerns that honourable members seem to have about the final paragraph of this bill, the power to amend the schedule, all we are doing is ensuring that in the context of these measures also, we are providing that lever. Because that will make it easier to do that which the honourable gentleman wishes to see. And I think I can deduce from the way that he has presented his statement today two wishes. The first is to have the legal clarity of the measures announced, whether they are the increases in dues or the increases in allowances and benefits, and B, to have a debate in this House about those increases or deductions or allowances. I am giving him at least the first, because the regulations which have been published already and these bills deal with the legal certainty. In the future, in relation to these measures, which are not the most controversial measures, I would imagine, that you're dealing with in the context of taxation, we will simply link them up to the ability which their party provided under the Income Tax Act to be able to provide the amendments to these measures by way of regulation. Mr. Speaker, from a recollection, I will look at it again, what the measure for amendment by regulation will provide is for the amendment of the amount of expenditure, allowance, or deduction, and the period of time. So, I mean, it's hardly the greatest usurpation of this Parliament's powers in the context of this new amendment, which we've introduced during the course of the debate this week, to be able to change those parameters, Mr. Speaker. Because the parameters that might really matter, for goodness sake, the corporate rate of tax in Gibraltar, they have already provided for, should be something that is amendable by regulation, as we have demonstrated, as are all the other matters that I've provided for. And, Mr. Speaker, I do think that it's important to reflect that in the way that they brought appropriations to this House, and I say they, Mr. Speaker, because at the same time that in 2011 the Honourable Gentleman was wishing a pox in the houses of both the GSD and the GSLP Liberals, until 2003 he had been an integral member of the GSD House in this House. And already in that period, the practice of an appropriation debate akin to a UK budget debate, State of the Nation announcements that as from midnight tonight, had been happening here. So it ill behoves the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Speaker, to disassociate himself not just with the things that his party used to do when he was no longer in it or when he was no longer in this House. It ill behoves for the Honourable Gentleman to disassociate himself from himself and his own actions, because he was here, sitting next to the then Leader of the House and applauding his mechanisms. He's shaking his head, Mr. Speaker, which no doubt will make people wonder, whether they can ever consider credible anything that he does. Because if he was sitting here supporting the budgets of the Honourable, the former Chief Minister, and he didn't mean it, I mean, it's quite remarkable, Mr. Speaker. No, Mr. Speaker, I am not rerunning the debate. The Honourable Gentleman is wrong. I am addressing exactly the point that they have raised. No, Mr. Speaker, this is the usual story from the Honourable Gentleman of trying not to be accountable for the things that he has done as a member of this Parliament. As a member of this Parliament, he sat here and he supported the practice that he now decries. And that practice, Mr. Speaker, was to bring an appropriation bill, have a State of the Nation debate, and announce increases in dues from the public, not provide a finance bill, which he now considers would have been an essential and proper thing to do, and provide for those increases to be charged to individuals without legal cover, Mr. Speaker. He's now saying that that is not appropriate. Well, Mr. Speaker, it was as appropriate when we might have needed to do it as when they wanted to do it. But what's more, Mr. Speaker, what is more? They left behind a trail of evidence, not just in Hansard, but in the Income Tax Act. In the Income Tax Act, the GSD Income Tax Act, which he is not responsible for because he wasn't here in this House to do it. He was by then in the PDP, and because I've read all his press releases this week in preparation for Tuesday, Mr. Speaker, I can recall what he was saying in respect of the Income Tax Act was that it was long overdue. It was long overdue. So, Mr. Speaker, when we raise those dues in exercise of the regulatory power that they gave us as government of Gibraltar, it doesn't appear to them to be right. But, Mr. Speaker, I think that is simply further evidence of their legislative hypocrisy. They think that they can create legislative powers for ministers which are in safe hands when they are the ministers, and that it is really quite unacceptable for us as ministers to give effect to the regulatory power that they have in law created. So, therefore, Mr. Speaker, without wanting to rerun the debate that we've had earlier, but addressing this key issue, I think it's fundamental to show that honourable members' position changes whether when they are legislators and when they are opposition members. And that, Mr. Speaker, brings me to the next point that the Honourable Gentleman raises.
when he says that it is, because he says so, disingenuous to suggest that it is at the very least peculiar that an opposition that has voted against a budget then comes to this House, for reasons that I am grateful, to support a measure announced in the budget. And not just the measure, Mr. Speaker, that is the collection of dues. In other words, they've supported the Imports and Exports Amendment, which raises dues. They are supporting the measure which also provides taxpayers of relief, which is this measure. Mr. Speaker, if they might have had the slightest point, they had it in relation to the first bill. They certainly don't have it in relation to this bill. This bill is part of the appropriation for a simple reason. The appropriation is the taking of money to do a thing. In effect, by relieving the public purse of the benefits of the tax that we would raise, because we are giving this relief and these allowance, we are giving and therefore applying monies by not raising them. So, Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely nonsensical for them to say that the appropriation bill was not about this, and that they voted in the appropriation bill against the measure because this has nothing to do with it, when this is one of the key elements that we provided for. But indeed, Mr. Speaker, where they are right, and because they have focused on it now, it's important that we take the benefit of them having highlighted what they didn't vote in favour of, what they have expressly again today doubled down in saying they didn't vote in favour of, what's the spending, the direct spending, because they are not happy, Mr. Speaker, with the spending that is provided for in the book, because that is the spending that is provided for in the bill, that the spending is provided for in the book. And Mr. Speaker, the spending that is provided for in the book is the spending for the public services and for the public servants. So they confirm that they have not supported that spending, but that they do come here to support the raising of the revenues under the Import Duties Act and the allowances that we are introducing now. So, Mr. Speaker, frankly, it is not disingenuous to point out to the Honourable Gentleman that there is a great incongruity between the position that they take during the debate on the Appropriation Bill and the position that they're taking now. It is disingenuous of the Honourable Gentleman to suggest that it is not disingenuous. And as ever, Mr. Speaker, I speak fully convinced that when someone finally decides that they want to read every volume of our Hansard and work out how this debate originates many years ago, we were true and honest to a position, and they moved from pillar to post depending on where they were sitting, as best exemplified today by their attitude, Mr. Speaker, to regulations providing for the amendment of rates, dates, and other provisions of the Income Tax Act when they were legislators, but now thinking it is not the right thing to do. Mr. Speaker, the other point to make is that things being delayed years is something which is never going to be something that we wish to see happen. And there are some circumstances where it is unfortunately inevitable, as I have indicated to the House in the context of the supplementary appropriation bills. But, Mr. Speaker, honourable members have to remember that they represent in this House those who brought the legislation delayed years, even in the context of social insurance contributions, which is a deduction from pay. So, our concerns sometimes provided for a few weeks, but then sometimes provided for many months. And I think from my discussion a moment ago with the Father of the House, some delays which went beyond 12 months. And I think on one particular occasion, we were amending to provide for social insurance contributions for 2 years. In other words, we amended backwards to year X and then year Y in 1 year of legislation, because the amendment had had caught up with itself. I can't provide the actual date here, but it's the recollection of both the father of the House and me, so it must have been in the period when I was already an opposition member of this House. And that, frankly, Mr. Speaker, concerned us greatly for the reasons I've already indicated in relation to the Truck Act. Mr. Speaker, there are no huge hikes in social insurance. It is absolute nonsense to suggest that there are huge hikes in social insurance. It is just not true, Mr. Speaker. In my discussions with members of the business community since the budget debate, many have told me, well, we don't like it when you raise anything, and we had to say something. But, you know, I will put in that context the thing I have heard today from the Honourable Lady about huge hikes in social insurance, because there are no such huge hikes. The point I would make in this respect, Mr. Speaker, which I think is an important one to make in particular to commercial individuals, to people who own the businesses that we're talking about, not so much to working people, is that those who own businesses and companies in Gibraltar, many of them, not all of them, have private medical insurance. Many, not all of them, have private medical insurance. When their private medical insurance provider, whether it be Bupa PPP, AXA PPP, or any other provider, sends them an annual letter, and it's usually an annual letter, telling them that their contributions are going up by a particular amount and that their direct debits are going to be increased, most, Mr. Speaker, don't bat an eyelid. Yet when the pandemic hit, the 60% of the social insurance contribution that they give, which goes to the GHA, is what enabled the GHA, with the support of the taxpayer, to be the entity that provided the additional ventilators with the support of the community, that provided the wards, including the Florence Nightingale Ward, that provided, with the help of the United Kingdom, the vaccinations and the people providing the vaccinations. So nobody in the commercial class bats an eyelid when their private medical insurance goes up, and yet when their social insurance goes up, despite the fact that 40% of it goes to their own pension and 60% of it goes to the medical provision that has seen us proudly through at least the phases we are through already of the pandemic. People say that this is a hike too far and huge. Mr. Speaker, look, we've got to get real. We've got to stop pandering to the things that are not real and people understand. And the commercial classes in Gibraltar fully understand these things, and we are doing ourselves no favours by pretending otherwise in this House for the purposes of the partisan political debate, which we're not taking anywhere with those sterile arguments, Mr. Speaker. If businesses in Gibraltar need more help in the coming months, the government, it will be considering with the business representative organisations and for itself how we can provide that help. But raising social insurance, Mr. Speaker, is but a drop in the ocean of the considerable assistance that this government has given to most, if not all, businesses in Gibraltar. Those that have not had the assistance have not had it because they've come to the government through their representative organisations to say, look, we don't need it, we can go on, this is a difficult time, you shouldn't be using taxpayers' money to help us, we can go on. And, Mr. Speaker, I'm also bound to reflect to honourable members the very important number of businesses who have returned to the assistance that we've already given them, Mr. Speaker, because they've been able to turn things around for themselves and they have wanted to support the taxpayer and wanted to demonstrate their gratitude for the work done by the taxpayer in supporting businesses by returning funds that they had in the pandemic. Mr. Speaker, that is the reality that sees us bring this bill to this House for the purposes of providing for the deductions and allowances that I announced in my appropriation bill addresses. I commend the bill to the House.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010 be read a second time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Income Tax Amendment Number 3 Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the clerks seek to print this text slightly larger next time. Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill will be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to confer powers to police officers and authorised persons relating to small and unmanned aircraft and requirements in the Civil Aviation Act 2009 and subsidiary legislation to provide for fixed penalties for certain offences relating to small unmanned aircraft and for connected purposes. The Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to confer powers to police officers and authorised persons relating to small unmanned aircraft and requirements in the Civil Aviation Act 2009 and subsidiary legislation to provide for fixed penalties for certain offences relating to small unmanned aircraft and for connected purposes be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to confer powers to police officers and authorised persons relating to small unmanned aircraft and requirements in the Civil Aviation Act 2009 and subsidiary legislation to provide for fixed penalties for certain offences relating to small unmanned aircraft and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Small Unmanned Aircraft Offences Act 2020.
I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. And I give notice, Mr. Speaker, that at the committee stage of the bill, the year 2020 will need to be changed to 2021 in different parts of the bill. Mr. Speaker, this bill aims to reproduce the equivalent measures introduced by the Air Traffic Management and Unmanned Aircraft Legislation Progress in the UK Parliament. The objective is to create offences for the misuse of equipment commonly known as drones. The misuse of such equipment poses serious safety and security concerns. First, to the safety of aircraft. Secondly, to the safety of persons living in the urban environment. And thirdly, to wildlife living in the environmentally protected areas of the Upper Rock and BGTW. Those concerns have been brought to the attention of the government by the Director of Civil Aviation. The House will record that between the 19th and the 21st of December 2018, hundreds of flights were grounded at Gatwick Airport, following reports of drone activity in the area. This is perhaps the most well-known incident, but it is sadly not the only one. There is a constant and continuous misuse of these devices all over the planet, and Gibraltar is no exception to this general rule. Part of the reason for this explosion in their use is because drones have become smaller and more affordable. Mr. Speaker, this bill is therefore modelled on the bill before the Westminster Parliament. However, it has been adapted to meet the particular circumstances of Gibraltar. The bill, as I said, seeks to address the safety and security concerns which arose in the United Kingdom, and also to tackle the environmental concerns which have become all too apparent here in Gibraltar. Indeed, one area where the misuse of drones has been reported is the Upper Rock. This can cause an adverse effect on the environment and on wildlife. The smaller drones are sometimes mistaken for birds of prey by nesting or breeding birds. The larger drones have been known to scare away macaques who operate when operated in close proximity to them. The bill therefore serves more than one purpose, and it is structured in that way. Honourable members will have seen that the proposed legislation envisages a multi-agency approach to the enforcement of the offences that will be created. The enforcement rests on three categories of officials. The first category are police officers who have full powers of enforcement. The second category are defined as authorised officers who have full powers of enforcement with the exception of the power in Section 6 to enter and search premises under a warrant. The third category are defined as authorised persons, and their powers will be more limited. Mr. Speaker, the bill proposes that the authorised officers will be the Royal Gibraltar Police and HM Customs. This allows also for the involvement of the Gibraltar Defence Police. The latter would act under the provisions of Section 78 of the Police Act 2006 and the Memorandum of Understanding between the Royal Gibraltar Police and the Ministry of Defence. Customs officers are also an essential part of the enforcement framework. Honourable members will have seen that they are on constant patrol all over Gibraltar. It is therefore for this reason that they will have all the powers of a police officer except the powers in relation to Section 6 to enter and search premises under a warrant. The authorised persons with more limited powers under the bill are officers of the Borders and Coast Guard Agency and the Environmental Protection Officers. BCA officers, Mr. Speaker, are present in all the entry points to Gibraltar, but also importantly in the area of the air terminal and the runway. The functions of environmental protection officers under the bill are limited geographically only to the Upper Rock Nature Reserve and to British Gibraltar territorial waters. This legislation was drafted in consultation with the Royal Gibraltar Police. The objective behind the expansion of enforcement powers to other agencies is in order to improve the timeliness of the response to the flight of a drone. It is important to understand that drones are in the air for a relatively short period of time, typically 25 minutes, without a battery charge. The inclusion of other agencies improves the response time, particularly, as I said earlier, in respect of the environmental protection officers, who have a direct interest in enforcement, as they continue to witness the occasional misuse of drones on the Upper Rock. Mr. Speaker, this bill improves the enforcement of the small unmanned aircraft provisions in the Civil Aviation Air Navigation Regulations of 2009 and of certain offences in the Prison Act. The bill includes powers to A, to require a small unmanned aircraft to be grounded, B, to stop and search persons, vessels and vehicles in specific circumstances, C, to enter and search premises under a warrant, and D, to issue fixed penalty notices in certain situations. The above reflects a potential seriousness of any given situation that Gibraltar could find itself in. This cannot be underestimated. Mr. Speaker, an unauthorized person is able to require an operator to ground a small unmanned aircraft where there is reasonable belief that an offense is being or is likely to be committed. This again is a means of providing immediate enforcement. It will also serve to act as a significant deterrent to anyone thinking of using a small unmanned aircraft illegally. There is currently no existing power which permits a police officer to require a person to ground a small unmanned aircraft in the circumstances provided for in the bill. The provision of the bill, Mr. Speaker, provide an authorised officer with the power to stop and search any person, vessel or vehicle or anything in or on a vessel or a vehicle. This power applies where the authorised officer has reasonable grounds for suspecting that they will find a small unmanned aircraft and or any article associated with a small unmanned aircraft which is or has been involved in the commission of certain offences in the Civil Aviation Air Navigation Regulations or the Prison Act. Where relevant, the provisions of the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 apply to the seizure and retention of property. Small unmanned aircraft offences in the Civil Aviation Regulation and the bill are summary-only offences. This means that the existing provisions for entry and search powers into premises which exist for indictable offences cannot be used for the misuse of drones. The police are therefore not able to adequately investigate small unmanned aircraft-related offences. The bill proposes to put in place a warrant process, which will safeguard the use of this power by involving the independent judgment of a magistrate. The result of this is that the police would need to justify their case for a warrant to enter and search premises to an independent third party. Mr. Speaker, the bill therefore provides for an amendment to Schedule 14 of the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011, allowing for searching premises under warrant to be extended to the offences appearing in Sections 4 and 5 of the bill. The powers in the bill for authorised persons to require proof of small unmanned aircraft operator registration or remote pilot competency will assist enforcement of these requirements. Those powers will also assist authorised persons to enforce other requirements in the regulations. This comes with the power to require the production of evidence of any exemption or permission in relation to the regulations that apply to the particular flights. The bill refers to requirements under the Civil Aviation Air Navigation Regulations and creates powers in relation to those requirements. For the record, the term small unmanned aircraft, Mr. Speaker, relates to any unmanned aircraft other than a balloon or kites having a mass of not more than 20 kilograms without its fuel, but including any articles or equipment installed in or attached to the aircraft at the commencement of the flight. Finally, the bill also provides a power to issue fixed penalty notices for fixed penalty offences. The use of this power is limited to less serious offences. Mr. Speaker, this bill addresses a vacuum in our legislation. The equipment that it seeks to regulate is relatively new. It has become apparent from incidents elsewhere that the misuse of such equipment can lead to serious safety and security concerns in respect of both persons and of aircraft. In Gibraltar, there are also environmental concerns and the problem we face in living in an intense urban environment. The Director of Civil Aviation, for this reason, has consulted widely with law enforcement agencies and other relevant bodies. This includes the Commission of Police, the Collector of Customs, the CEO of the Borders and Coast Guard Agency, and the Ministry for the Environment. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, we're grateful for the Deputy Chief Minister's comprehensive setting out of the rationale for this bill, which we support. We will vote in favour. We consider it appropriate and necessary for all the reasons that he has given, which was clear. At least not in such detail. It was certainly clear when we read the bill that this certainly posed dangers of that type and that the police needed such enforcement powers, and we will certainly support it.
The Honourable Marlene Hassan-Nolan.
Mr. Speaker, I echo the words of the Leader of the Opposition. I thank the Deputy Chief Minister for his exhaustive contribution and also consider it a necessary piece of legislation, which I will, of course, be voting in favour of. Thank you.
The Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank the Honourable Members for their support.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to confer powers to police officers and authorised persons relating to small unmanned aircraft and requirements in the Civil Aviation Act 2009 and subsidiary legislation to provide for fixed penalties for certain offences relating to small unmanned aircraft and for connected purposes be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against, carried.
Small Unmanned Aircraft Offences Act 2020.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to amend the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Act 2018. The Honourable the Minister for the Health Authority, Justice, Multiculturalism, Equality and Community Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Act 2018 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Act 2018 be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Amendment Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Amendment Act 2020 be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, clauses 1 and 2 contain provisions in relation to the title and entry into force of the Act. Clause 3 amends certain sections of the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Act 2018, referred to as the 2018 Act, to implement in part specific provisions of the Additional Protocol to the European Convention on Mutual Assistance in Criminal Matters, dated the 17th of March 1978, the Additional Protocol, Mr. Speaker, which are not currently provided for in Gibraltar law. In addition, the bill also provides the following. A regulation-making power to amend the 2018 Act by regulation for the purposes of implementing international conventions and agreements, and B, a clause restricting the use of any information or evidence provided by the judicial authority in Gibraltar under a request for assistance to prevent the equivalent authority in a contracting state from using this information or evidence for another purpose without the consent of the judicial authority in Gibraltar. The European Convention on Mutual Assistance in Criminal Matters, dated the 20th of April 1959, already applies to Gibraltar and is given effect in our 2018 Act. This bill tweaks the Act so as to implement Chapter 1 of the Additional Protocol. There are three main chapters to the Additional Protocol, which each contracting state can agree to form part of or to reserve out of under Article 8. Gibraltar is seeking extension of Chapter 1 of the Additional Protocol, but with similar reservations to the United Kingdom, and is also reserving out of Chapters 2 and 3. Chapter 1 modifies the text of the Convention by removing the possibility of refusing mutual assistance requests in criminal matters, solely because the request concerns a fiscal offence. Gibraltar can still refuse to grant a request by relying on one of the grounds under Article 2B of the Convention. The Additional Protocol is an important post-transition arrangement following Brexit. I will now take each part of Clause 3 as they appear on the bill. Subclause 2. The amendments to Section 2 of the 2018 Act are necessary to implement Chapter 1 to the Additional Protocol, as they remove the exclusion of fiscal offences from the definition of relevant offence, and it also removes the reliance on the definition of offence in the Mutual Legal Assistance International Act 2005, which excludes fiscal offences. Subclause 3. The addition of Subclause 3 to Section 5 of the 2018 Act complies with Chapter 1 of the Additional Protocol, as it would allow mutual assistance requests for fiscal offences to be acceptable in Gibraltar. The new subsection 5.3 to the 2018 Act provides that the Mutual Legal Assistance International Act 2005 is to be read for the purposes of the 2018 Act as including fiscal offences. Subclause 4. The addition of Section 11A imposes a necessary restriction on any relevant authority in a contracting state to the use made of the information and evidence obtained from the judicial authority in Gibraltar. In essence, the authorities in other contracting states cannot use the information or evidence from the judicial authority in Gibraltar for any other purpose than that specified in their request for mutual assistance. Subclause 5. A new Section 18 is proposed for the 2018 Act. This is a regulation-making power to make amendments to the 2018 Act by regulation for the sole and limited purpose of implementing conventions and international agreements. There are similar provisions in other acts, to name but a few. Section 1842 of the Proceeds of Crimes Act 2015, Section 129G of the Imports and Exports Act 1986, Section 15211F of the Terrorism Act 2018, Section 223A1B of the Merchant Shipping Act. And Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable, the Leader of Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, certainly grateful for the explanation of the Minister, because it wasn't immediately obvious from the explanatory memorandum, unless you had regard to the protocol next to reading the bill itself.
Can I just ask her to perhaps deal in her reply? Is there any other sort of motivation in terms of this? Is this bill coming from some kind of concern in respect of our current legislation? Because obviously the protocol that she relies on is a 1978 protocol. It's been kicking around for quite a while. So what is it that motivates taking this legislation now in this way? Is it related to perhaps that you know, we've left the European Union and therefore that we're now relying on the protocol? Is that what it is? Is the government concerned in respect of the fiscal offences that we may not get reciprocity from other countries in the context of our departure from the EU?
Does any... The Honourable Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, the Honourable Member is right in that he refers to this being one of the consequential matters arising out of Brexit arrangements. And it is, in a sense, a formality in relation to fiscal offences. So the legislation is being amended in order to cover that respect. So what this does, Mr. Speaker, is replaces that regime that we had before.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Act 2018 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Amendment Act 2021.
I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today, if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today.
A bill for an act to amend the Private Sector Pensions Act 2019 to replace a pensions commissioner, to make consequential amendments arising from the enactment of the Financial Services Act 2019, and to make provisions for sizes of employers and for connected purposes. The Honourable the Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Private Sector Pensions Act 2019 to replace the Pensions Commissioner, to make consequential amendments arising from the enactment of the Financial Services Act 2019 and to make provision for sizes of employers and for connected purposes be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend Private Sector Pensions Act 2019 to replace the Pensions Commissioner, to make consequential amendments arising from the enactment of the Financial Services Act 2019 and to make provision for sizes of employers and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Private Sector Pensions Amendment Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill amends the Private Sector Pensions Act of 2019, which was enacted to ensure that private sector workers were entitled to choose whether they wish to make a contribution to a pension plan. It requires the employer to contribute towards that employee's pension plan if the employee so chooses to participate in such a plan. The Act did not come into force in 2019, but set out the dates of implementation for the different categories of employer, with the implementation for the largest category, i.e. enterprise employers, planned for the 1st of July 2021. This date has been slightly deferred, and the implementation for enterprise employers will now be the 1st of August 2021. The fundamental effect of the Pensions Act has not changed, but amendments have been made in order to update references to the financial services legislation, which underwent significant change since this Act was passed, and to facilitate the logistical and administrative aspects of the Act. The amendments also delay implementation of the Act for certain types of employers to give them some breathing room in circumstances where most businesses have been affected by the pandemic. The first significant amendment made by this bill is that the role of the Pensions Commissioner is to be carried out by the Gibraltar Financial Services Commission rather than the Commissioner for Income Tax. This facilitates matters, given that the GFSC already has regulatory responsibilities, experience and expertise in respect of pension schemes. A number of consequential amendments arise from that change, namely granting the Pensions Commissioner powers to delegate functions to employees of the GFSC and to exchange information with government departments to ensure a streamlined and simpler process for employers. The Act provided for the Pensions Commissioner to have the powers that the Income Tax Commissioner had under the Income Tax Act of 2010. In light of the change of the Pensions Committee to the GFSC, the bill introduces such powers expressly, including enforcement powers for the entry and search of premises upon receipt of a warrant issued by a magistrate in the event that there are suspicions that the Act is not being fully complied with. In addition, the bill allows members of the public to address complaints arising from the Act to the Financial Services Ombudsman. The bill also introduces the power for the Pensions Commissioner to charge employers a fee for registration under the Act, which will be necessary to cover the costs of administrative and supervisory work which will need to be undertaken as a result of the Act. Such costs are more appropriately funded by the private sector than the government. Lastly, Mr. Speaker, the bill changes the dates from which employers are required to comply with the provisions of the Act. In other words, the dates from which private sector employers need to begin making contributions to the pensions of those employees who have opted to contribute to a pension. In making this change, the bill introduces a new category of enterprise employer, being those who employ more than 251 employees. Only these largest employers will be required to comply with the Act this year from the 1st of August 2021. Under the Act, those employers who fell into the large category, namely those with between 101 and 250 employees, would have been required to comply this year, but the bill has pushed this back to 2022. The start date for all other categories of employers has been delayed by 1 year, except for the smallest category of employer, microemployers, whose implementation date remains the 1st of July 2027. This gives private sector businesses the breathing space which we understand they require after the effects of the pandemic, whilst also balancing the needs of private sector employees to provide for their futures. Mr. Speaker, I am grateful to the Financial Services Commission for undertaking to do this work, as well as the support in the preparation of this bill, particularly Junior Sacadillo, who has worked closely with us, as well as Gemma Vasquez and Tania Rahmani from Assans, who worked on the original Act and have now supported the work in relation to the preparation of this bill. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable Roy Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister for his introduction to the amendments to the Private Sector Pensions Act. We of course, supported the original bill, which became the Act, and obviously we will support anything that makes the administration and bringing into effect of this Act that is necessary to do those things that the Minister deems necessary to make this Act effective. But, Mr. Speaker, I have a couple of questions for the Minister that arise from the changes that have been introduced. Firstly, if the Minister could advise why it was that there was a change in definitions, because originally the scaling of the different types of employers was done on the basis of Schedule 9 of the Companies Act 2014, as listed in the Act that we debated some time ago. It's now changed to go by, not by that definition, but by numbers of employees, and I'd be grateful if the Minister could advise what was it that influenced that change of methodology, because of course the Companies Act definitions will be looking at other things, turnover, assets, not just employees. So I'd be interested to know what it was that has led to this change in thinking. And of course, the enterprise employer is a new category, which wasn't in the original Act. Yeah? And in terms of the Financial Services Commission, as a body, obviously I assume that the necessary work has been done in preparation for it, in order to enable them to undertake the administrative burden that this will require. There is one question I have, Speaker, and that goes to the back of the bill, which is there is a sort of one-liner at the very end, an explanatory memorandum. And it says, finally, this Act provides for immunity from sanctions available under the Act of the government in cases where the government acts as a pension provider or pension administrator. And I think that must refer to Clause 14, Item C, and it talks about amending, inserting a new Clause U. This is exempting in the public interest specific pension plans and their administrators from the provisions of this Act. And I'd be interested to know what the rationale for that is, because if you read the original bill, or rather the original Act, which didn't come into force, it does say quite clearly that this Act does not require pension plans provided in respect of employment or service that constitutes a public service within the meaning of the Pensions Act, and this Act does not apply to pensions established under the Social Security Insurance Act and any regulations thereafter, or thereunder. So I'm just curious to know why it is the government feels it needs this clause and in terms of effectively giving itself immunity where you are a pension provider. I can only imagine that case would arise where it's in relation of a pension provided by a government company. In terms of, I don't know whether that comes under the definition of public service or not. Yeah? But I do find it peculiar that there is a desire to insert this clause U, allowing for exemption in the public interest. I find it a bit hard to understand what the public interest could be, where they require exemption. And lastly, Mr. Speaker, in terms of the complaints procedure to the Financial Services Ombudsman, if this Act comes into force so that people or employers, certainly the enterprise employers will have to get this up and running for the 1st of August, I would imagine the Public Service Ombudsman has to at least be in place for when this legislation comes into force. I'd be grateful if the Minister gave an indication, unless I've missed it already, as to when he expects the public, the Financial Services Ombudsman legislation to be enacted, or rather put into force. Thank you, Speaker.
The Honourable Minister.
Mr. Speaker, dealing with the points the Honourable Member has raised, I think dealing with the last point first, the complaints procedure, Mr. Speaker, the very first, as the Honourable Member will know, group will be the enterprise employers of firms with over 251, which kicks off with effect from the 1st of August, which is a period of 3 months, during which they have to enter into those arrangements, so there's time for them to do that. And I would hope that within that period we'd be in a position to take the next step forward in the commencement of the Financial Services Ombudsman position, so I would hope there'd be no issue there. With respect to the immunity, this is a point that will arise, I suspect, later on towards the end of the implementation with a final group, what we call the micro employer, which is 14 or less. Those are the firms that are going to have very few members. It's unlikely they're going to set up their own pension plan. I believe the larger firms will probably set up their own pension plans for the employees. group pension plans. The further down you go, the smaller the firm becomes, the harder that will become. The cost of administering pension plans is expensive. And so when you've got very few employees, it's unlikely the firm will take the step to work to do that for their employees, and they may be subscribing to group pension plans, if I can call them that, and where the cost of administration of these plans is greatly reduced. I know there are some insurance providers in Gibraltar are looking at pooling of pension plans, where they're able to put the money together to reduce the cost. Otherwise, it would be ridiculous for the firm with 14 employees to set up a fully blown pension plan where the cost will outweigh the return they may make in any given year. And consequently, that is the reason why that clause is there. In the event of the government pension plans being made available to them, we don't want to find ourselves being on the wrong end of a lawsuit if something is done when all we're trying to do is pool monies and invest them in line with what we're doing for everyone else. Mr. Speaker, why have we changed the groupings? We changed the groupings because we felt, again on advice, and we've consulted on these, that it is better to start with a very, very large, which is why the new enterprise employer has been created. There are only 11 such firms which are impacted, which also gives us more time to see how this works through, identify and thrash out any changes that may be required in its functionality before we move on to extending it further. By having it over, I think it was 101 or 150 employees, this just gives us more time and there are fewer employees impacted in phase one. I would expect the first two categories will be offering group pension plans for their staff because they have the volume of people. Some of them already do. As you may know, any pension plan for a firm who have 99 members or more are already regulated by the Financial Services Commission. So those really are quite easy for them to take up because they're already registered and in a sense regulated. And so this will enable us to move more swiftly with those that already exist in the main before we move on to the others. So it really is just a practical way of enabling only the larger firms to be impacted at this stage before we move it out to next year and every year thereafter, kicking into the new schemes. I hope that deals with the honourable members' questions.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Private Sector Pensions Act 2019 to replace the Pensions Commissioner to make consequential amendments arising from the enactment of the Financial Services Act 2019 and to make provision for sizes of employers and for connected purposes be read a second time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Private Sector Pensions Amendment Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
Committee stage and third reading, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, before I move that we should go into the committee stage and third reading, I'm advised that today will likely be the last day that the clerk is with us, because tomorrow, although we will sit, he has a personal appointment that he needs to attend to. He has been kind enough, despite my doctor's and wife's advice, to provide for everyone a cake with tea, and if we continue now with the third reading, we're going to get to dinner time before we can enjoy with him the fruits of his kindness. So, Mr. Speaker, can I move with our best wishes that the House should recess for 15 minutes, and return when you think is appropriate on the hour or before, so that we can enjoy that with our dear Paul.
The House will recess for a reasonable period of time.
committee stage and third reading, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, a very reasonable time was had by all. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House should resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills, clause by clause. The Imports and Exports Miscellaneous Amendment Bill 2021, the Income Tax Amendment No. 3 Bill 2021, the Public Health Amendment Act, Amendment Bill 2020, the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Amendment Bill 2021, and the Private Sector Pensions Amendment Bill 2021.
A bill for an act to amend the Imports and Exports Act 1986 and the Integrated Tariff Regulations 2017. Clauses 1 to 4.
Clauses 1 to 4 stand part of the bill.
The long title.
The long title stands part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010. Clauses 1 to 3.
Clauses 1 to 3 stand part of the bill.
The long title.
The long title stands part of the bill.
A bill for an act to confer powers to police officers and unauthorised persons relating to small unmanned aircraft and requirements in the Civil Aviation Act 2009 and subsidiary legislation to provide for fixed penalties for certain offences relating to small unmanned aircraft and for connected purposes. Clause 1 as amended.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, simply to amend the dates from 2020 to 2021.
Clause 1 as amended stands part of the bill.
Clauses 2 to 3.
Clauses 2 to 3 stand part of the bill.
Part 1, clauses 4 to 7.
Part 1, clauses 4 to 7 stand part of the bill.
Part 2, clauses 8 to 11.
Part 2, clauses 8 to 11 stands part of the bill.
Part 3, clauses 12 and 13.
Part 3, clauses 12 and 13 stand part of the bill.
Part 4, clauses 14 to 17.
Part 4, clauses 14 to 17 stand part of the bill.
Part 5, clauses 18 to 20.
Part 5, clauses 18 to 20 stand part of the bill.
The schedule.
The schedule stands part of the bill.
Long title.
The long title stands part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Public Health Act to control the emission of smoke by vessels and for connected purposes. Clause 1 as amended.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Amendment Clause 1 is a change to the year 2021, as in the last bill we've just done.
Clause 1 as amended stands part of the bill.
Clause 2.
Clause 2 stands part of the bill.
Clause 3 as amended.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will refer to my letters of the 29th of June 2020 and the 3rd of June 2021 with proposed minor amendments.
Clause 3 as amended stands part of the bill.
The long title.
The long title stands part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Act 2018. Clauses 1 to 3.
Clauses 1 to 3 stand part of the bill.
The long title.
The long title stands part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Private Sector Pensions Act 2019 to replace the Pensions Commissioner, to make consequential amendments arising from the enactment of the Financial Services Act 2019, and to make provision for the sizes of employers and for connected purposes. Clauses 1 and 2.
Clauses 1 and 2 stand Chairman, part of the bill?
There's a letter of amendment today, which I've circulated, changing the date of commencement from the 1st of July 2021 to the 1st of August 2021.
Clause 3 as amended?
Clause 3 as amended stands part of the bill.
I'm grateful, Mr. Chairman, as I am for the cake that the clerk has delivered to us this afternoon.
The long title?
The long title stands part of the bill.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to report that... Excuse me. The Private Sector Pensions Amendment Bill 2021, the Imports and Exports Miscellaneous Amendment Bill 2021, the Income Tax Amendment Number 3 Bill 2021, the Public Health Amendment Bill 2020, the Register of Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Amendment Bill 2021 have been considered in committee and agreed to with some amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed.
I now put the question, which is that the Private Sector Pensions Amendment Bill 2021 as amended, the Imports and Exports Miscellaneous Amendment Bill 2021, the Income Tax Amendment Number 3 Bill 2021, the Small Unmanned Aircraft Offences Bill 20 as amended 2021, the Public Health Amendment Bill 2021, and the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Amendment Bill 2021 be read a third time and passed. Those in favour of the Private Sector Pensions Amendment Bill 2021?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Those in favour of the Imports and Exports Miscellaneous Amendment Bill 2021?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Those in favour of the Income Tax Amendment Number 3, Bill 2021?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Those in favour of the Small Unmanned Aircraft Offences Bill 2021?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Those in favour of the Public Health Amendment Bill 2021?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Those in favour of the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Amendment Bill 2021?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Mr. Speaker, given that the House has now concluded the bills that the government would wish to take through their stages before we adjourn for the summer, I move that the House should adjourn to tomorrow afternoon, and we will deal with government motions, of which I understand there will tomorrow be two that we can take, and those motions which honourable members may also have put on the order paper. So tomorrow at 3 p.m.
I now propose a question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Friday, the 30th of July at 3 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Friday, the 30th of July at 3 p.m. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Passed. This House will now adjourn to Friday, the 30th of July at 3 p.m.